Welcome to On Farm Trials with the PNW Farmers Network, where we explore the many trials that come along with cropping systems innovation in the inland Pacific Northwest. Plenty of questions get asked while farming across this region, and together, we're digging into what it's like to try to answer some of them as producers, researchers, and the many other professionals in the field that get things done. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Carol McFarland. Today, we're excited to be on the Rosenhoff Homestead outside of Ritzville, Washington, with Mr. Ron Geray, Dr. Bill Schillinger, Dr. Tim Politz, Dr. Surendra Singh, Dr. Jeremy Hansen, and Mr. Bruce Sauer. We are very excited to dive into the longest running dry land on-farm trial collaboration in Washington State. With that, we're looking forward to talking more and answering important questions to cropping systems innovation in our region and what that journey has looked like for almost three decades. Would you, Ron, please tell us just a little bit about yourself, who you farm with, and more about your farm and farming conditions?
Well, I farm with myself part of the time, and I work with some neighbors off and on over the years. This is the family farm. It was established in 1882, and so it's been around for a while. We've grown a little bit of everything over the years. We've done a little bit of canola. We've done peas. We've grown just about everything we can think about here over the years. So
I'm excited to hear more about that. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Dr. Schillinger, I bet you've grown about everything under the sun as well. Would you like to introduce a little bit about yourself and some of your research interests over the years and where you're at now?
Yes, I was a professor and scientist and director at Lynn Research Station for 29 years. And during that time, we did try to grow essentially any crop that could potentially grow out here. And I won't name them all off, but many of those were here on the Geray farm and certainly at Lynn and other places as well.
Great. Thanks. I look forward to hearing a little bit more of your history as well. But with that, let's have Dr. Politz introduce himself.
I'm Tim Politz, a research plant pathologist with USDA ARS in Pullman. When I've joined in year 2000, I actually took over from Jim Cook, who was my predecessor, who was instrumental in establishing this plot out here. And over the last 20 or so years, I've specialized in soil-borne pathogens of all the rotation crops, both fungi and nematodes, looking at ecology, epidemiology, and management. And then probably last 15 years, my research has moved a lot into the soil microbiome as the technology developed. And so looking at soil health, looking at the core microbiome of wheat, a lot of questions that we've kind of tried to answer out here. So that's kind of my background.
Great, thanks. All right, Dr. Singh?
Yep, so I am Surendra Singh, and I am an assistant professor and director at Lynn Station. And following Dr. Schillinger's footprint, continuing his legacy and building on to the program he built over the past 30 years here at, mostly working on dryland agronomy and related issues around dryland wheat, peas, canola, ranging from soil nutrient management to acidity to soil health to soil microbiology and however we can improve our dryland systems.
Well, it's a great legacy and really excited to see your trajectory as well. Dr. Hansen?
Jeremy Hansen. I have been working for the USDA Agricultural Research Service for 21 years. The first soil core I took as an employee for the ARS was here on Ron Geray's farm. And during my time at the USDA, I had the opportunity to get a PhD. Bill Schillinger was my major advisor. Tim Politz was on my committee, and we did some really interesting work on canola as a rotational crop and some of the effects of that. So I've really enjoyed working with this group and with working with Ron Geray.
Nice. So now you're the PLFA master for the Northwest Sustainable Agroecosystems Research Unit.
I seem to do a lot of that, yes.
Awesome. And Bruce, would you take a minute to introduce yourself and how instrumental you are at making research happen?
My name is Bruce Sauer, and I actually came to the Lynn Station in 1986 to work as a research technician in our breeding program, and since moved on to being the farm manager there. And so these long-term projects, I've been involved in everything from since they started, from, you know, filling in when Bill was between technicians and harvesting and doing the field work. So,
okay. Thanks so much for all of those introductions, and happy to welcome you all to the podcast. Thanks for taking your time to spend with us today to hear a little bit more about this exciting research collaboration. How did it get started, the on-farm trials here at your farm, Ron?
Oh, let's see. I was at the chemical dealership one day, and the representative from Monsanto showed up, and we're sitting there visiting, and it started kind of with the fields of tomorrow. And that was in 96, I think we did that. And Monsanto threw a whole bunch of money at us. Not at us, but at that project. And we had over 1,200 people out here at the farm that day demonstrating what Roundup could do as far as chemical mowing for CRP and takeout of CRP. And we had, if I remember right, we had like 6 or 7 different drills, all the way from conventional tillage to no tillage on the takeout of CRP. We demonstrated as well out in the field on some stubble and some other things. So it was quite an eventful day. And that was kind of the genesis of the whole thing. And it was like, okay, how do we actually make this work? Because it hadn't, nobody done anything like this out here at all. There hadn't even been any research into it at all. I mean, we'd looked at one of the driving things that was behind all that was control of cheatgrass. We didn't have anything for control of cheatgrass at that time, herbicide wise. And so the only real alternative was spring cropping, to try and do spring cropping more efficiently without a bunch of tillage passes was also in the back of my head as we were doing this. And that was one of the things that drove, like, okay, can we go in and spray and have a drill and just seed straight into it in the spring? And continuous spring cropping really was never the idea to begin with, but it was kind of where we ended up because we didn't have the capability of doing chem fallow at that time.
Just to clarify, is your farm all in no-till now?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Sounds like that might have been part of the beginning of that journey.
Yeah.
Bill, do you want to tell your version of how this all got started?
Yeah, well, Ron correctly pointed out the Monsanto field day out here in 1996, and that got a lot of us thinking about what we could do. This area is wheat fallow, tillage-based wheat fallow, especially in the 90s, 95% plus. One crop every 2 years. Wind erosion was a big concern.
Yeah, sounds dusty.
Beyond dusty, soil quality issues, massive brownout storms. Some of this tillage could get very intensive. And this has been going on since the onset of farming in 1880. So we got together and said, certainly we can do better. I was interested. I was fairly new and stationed at Lind. I might point out that Lind and Ritzville are two unique environments. Ritzville's way more forgiving. It gets 2 inches more precipitation per year, but it's got at least a 20 bushel per acre yield potential increase over Lind. So I was doing work at Lind, of course, at Lind Station, but I was, and Ron and I were friends, and we did some on-farm work on some other things. And we started talking and said, well, how about we do a really big long-term cropping systems experiment on your farm? And let's start off by going annual spring cropping, something really wild, growing a crop every year. And not only that, planting in the spring. Kim mentioned that Jim Cook was instrumental. Jim Cook said, Bill, Ron, please put two back-to-back broadleaf crops together in one of those rotations, and you will completely eliminate wheat-borne soil diseases. And we said, really? Okay, well, we better do that because Jim Cook says that'll happen. So we did, and we had a number of rotations, continuous spring wheat, spring wheat barley. We had two spring wheats followed by yellow mustard and safflower, those being the broadleaf crops, all annual cropping. And we did that for the first 8 years of this long-term study, covering 20 acres. So again, and it's still 20 acres today. So it's a pretty good sized experiment. That's how we started.
Great. Thanks for that. So kind of the summary of that would be this 20 acre multi-treatment back-to-back spring crops.
The first 8 years.
The first 8 years.
And then we transitioioned.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'd like to add something because this became a disease nursery. And that's kind of where I came in around 2000. So we knew that Rhizoctonia bare patch could be a problem out here. And when Ron started that transition to direct seed for about 2 years, there wasn't a problem, right?
Right.
And yeah. Then all of a sudden, these patches started to show up everywhere.
When was the transition to direct seed?
97, 96, 97. That particular field that the plots are on actually was in 96. We seeded it to spring wheat. So it had a year of everything being conformed before separating it off into plots, and the research plots then started in 97.
Okay. And this has been direct seed the whole way. Okay.
Yes.
So yeah. Rhizoctonia.
Rhizoctonia. And so this is an interesting disease because it forms a hyphal network, and we'd kind of known that tillage would probably break up the hyphal network. So then if you stop the tillage, it could become a problem. But we really documented after about 3 years, we started seeing these Rhizoctonia patches. And of course, as a pathologist, my eyes lit up. I said, this is something we can work on. So let's use this as an experiment to figure out how to manage this. And so one of the things that Jim Cook did, he thought that rotation would be a way of managing that disease. But lo and behold, we saw the patches in the other crops as well. So that was interesting information that this pathogen, this disease, has a wide host range. And so that you really could not manage it doing that way. You also tried different openers, other things we looked at, but we never really found anything that was really effective. But Mother Nature came into play here. So after about 5 years, we started noticing that these patches were disappearing. And one of the things we had done, Harry Schaefer for about 5 years had mapped all these patches on that 20 acres. So this was back in the time when GPS was first released by the military, declassified. So we had the first time high resolution GPS units, but they're not like your phone now. This was a whole backpack that he'd walk around and spend days
with an antenna on the back.
With an antenna and walking around and creating these elaborate maps, which nobody had ever done before. And we noticed after a few years that some of these patches started to disappear. And we thought, this is a great example of disease suppression. We knew it had happened in Australia. Nobody had documented it here. And this was at the time when the molecular techniques started to develop. So we could go to a patch that was there last year, disappeared this year, and look at the microbiome and see what could have been responsible for that. And so we could look at patches that disappeared, patches that stayed the same, or newly formed patches. So that was kind of my interest in this from a disease standpoint. We documented it reached a peak after about 5 years, and then the patches started to disappear. So it was natural suppression due to microbes that essentially managed that disease. So you can go out now and not find any patches at all. So that was an example, I guess, of where, despite all of our best efforts thinking we were going to manage it, Mother Nature took care of it. So a lot of papers were generated from that pathology work.
So what was the, was there a, what do you attribute that correlation in the suppressive soils?
Well, there are microbes that colonize the roots that are suppressive to Rhizoctonia. And we had known this. You know, Jim Cook built his whole career on suppression of takeol, which is another disease, very similar mechanisms due to bacteria on the root that actually grow better on diseased roots. And so you start to get this displacement. They're producing antibiotics and other things. And over time, the microbes essentially suppress the disease And so that's what happened. So that was the first part of my research on there for that first few years, really pathology oriented. And then it kind of shifted later with Jeremy's work on effective rotation crops.
Great. I'm excited to hear more about that. So how about the agronomy of some of those early lessons learned and how that helped shape maybe how the trajectory came along the way?
Planting spring crops out here is a recipe for a train wreck. That's one lesson learned. We have not yet had a successful spring crop that we can grow in the long term. We might get a good crop one or 2 years in a row, then we'll have a disaster. And that was the case out here as well. It just can't compete with winter wheat fallow. We've grown, tried lots of crops.
One of the other things that we don't have a representative here today, but was the economics, because that was when we sat down, what are the economics of this? Because the question was, can we even do it? We knew that we had a cheatgrass problem. We knew that we had some other issues that we were going to try and address. What can we do? And so we just kind of started doing things. And the first question was, how is it going to compare economically to the winter wheat fallow rotation, which is king? So that was also part of it. Didn't matter if it was continuous spring wheat, continuous spring wheat barley rotation. The two broadleaf rotations were almost a disaster, big time, as compared to the spring wheat, continuous spring wheat and the spring barley. And part of that was because of markets availability. But the fluctuation in precipitation, which dictates your yield, whether it's on an annual basis or a biannual basis, messes with the, because it's not a direct correlation between half the inputs, because it's what was the number that they came up with, about 2/3?
Yeah.
It costs a lot more money to grow a crop every year than it does every other.
Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully that's redeemed by being able to sell a crop every year instead of every other year, but it sounds like that might not be the case.
No, we've had several economists.
That was Doug Young
and Dave Archer from ARS, and it's just didn't make it, not even close, the spring crops.
Yeah. And the other thing, that those were drought years, if I remember.
No, that even was, wet years, it would hang in there.
But then in the dry years.
Yeah, that was the issue, is the inconsistency of precipitation. Mm-hmm. Is on a wet year, everything looked great, paper-wise, crop-wise. And then you'd get a dry year, and we actually had some really dry years in there, and
it looked like cancer out there with that rhizoctonia. Mm-hmm. And 4-bushel wheat. And it was like, yeah. But our first year, 1997, we had 19 inches of rain here. And Ron and I held a field day. That was the first year of our trial.
That's
and
the we year had to a hold whole, a field day right there.
Yeah, we looked brilliant.
And they said, what the heck is this crop? And we said, that's yellow mustard. What's that one? That's safflower. And it was just, of course, looking superb. And the spring wheat that year yielded 63 bushels per acre. For spring wheat at Ritzville.
Yeah, that's different than 4.
Yeah, but we had 4 as well.
Yeah. One of the questions that intrigues me, I have to put on my soil science hat a little bit, and I'm curious because it sounds like, the inception of this trial came around the time you were transitioning your tillage management as well. And so, would just from a speculation standpoint, what have you seen from your soils? Is there more evenness year to year since you maybe have been building up carbon in your soil that might have changed that dynamic early on?
Well, the one thing that the traditional fallow rotation does is it completely destroys organic matter. And it drops down to 0.6, 0.8% and somewhere in there. I mean, it can be in that range. It might be a little bit higher, but it stays there. And we looked at native soils, and they're not a whole lot better, but they're approaching 2%, right about that?
I think about 1.5.
1.5. But so it's like, how do we get back to that point as well? And so it's like, okay, we need to leave more residue. We need to cut back on the tillage. And we actually did move things up a little bit, not much.
Okay. So you think that if you were to run the trials with your soils now in, is that almost 30 years of no-till?
28.
Yeah. I think we're already seeing that more evenness from year to year.
Yeah.
It's this last fall, for example, was not the best seeding conditions. In fact, they downright sucked. But yet on some of the stuff that we looked at of the neighbors that have been doing the no-till now for going on 3 crops, 6 years or so, they got some beautiful stands as compared to where the conventional stuff was hard to get to the moisture. So there's things going on that we haven't identified at all yet, but that's got to have future work. Got to have something for Surrender to do.
Absolutely. We're going to hear about that. But I guess I'm curious about that kind of year-to-year evenness and the shift in tillage management that kind of came along with that asking of the question and how that might have impacted or the work. And if you guys, Tim and Bill, have any response to that.
Well, you know, when I first came here, that was probably the biggest management change that we were trying to effect was converting to direct seed, getting more farmers to do that. And there was a big interest in it. They started the Direct Seed Association around that time. So there were a lot of pioneers that were really pushing that. And I remember the first few years when they did the surveys in the high rainfall area, you know, how dismal those numbers looked in terms of how many people were doing direct seed. I remember Dennis Rowe, he had worked a lot on that. But now there's a high percentage of them. And then we always thought out here in this area here, you know, this will never happen. But now the last few years, with the work of Derek Schaefer and others, it looks like that's starting to take hold. And my interest from a disease standpoint was how can, you know, are there diseases that are going to become more important when you make that transition and what will happen? And in fact, that was right around the time when Kurt Schroeder was my PhD student. And we tried to duplicate that in trials. That was his thesis, where we specifically inoculated plots with and without rhizoctonia and could see the same thing by the third year that it became a big problem and then suppressed. And we could even do it in the greenhouse. We could take cores out of this area here that had bare patch, cycle them through 2 or 3 plantings of wheat or barley in the greenhouse, and the disease would disappear. So that's a reproducible phenomenon.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that, Tim. What's your response to this question, Bill?
I don't think it probably changes that much for spring crops. Spring crops are driven by spring precipitation, rain, most specifically May rain. That is super important. May rain and the first 2 weeks of June. That's what's driving your spring crop rather than tillage. But with that said, and Ron was alluding to it, farmers out here have tilled, not only for, you know, for various reasons, but mostly these days, the ones that are still tilling are doing the tillage during fallow to set a moisture line, which is very effective.
A dust mulch?
It doesn't have to be. I don't like the term dust mulch, although many of these farmers still end up with a dust mulch. You can do conservation tillage and have a still plenty of residue that's not going to blow on you. But yet you have to know how to do it. And you need special implement for that, an undercutter type thing. But that was a big driver that, oh, we'd never make the no-till work out here because we'd lose all our seed zone moisture. And so that's still the reason that I think most of these farmers around here are still tilling. But there's innovators, Ron, and you know, you mentioned Derek Schaefer and others, that are doing this. And one thing we noticed in this particular trial is after our experience with continuous annual spring cropping, and that after 8 years, we said, well, we've been through 2 cycles of that. We're going to publish some papers and we're going to move on. We tried some other things, but in the last many, many years, it's been comparing 3 3-year rotations that have been the most important. It involves chem follow and canola, chem follow, triticale, chem follow, winter wheat. To just summarize, we've noticed that we are not having that much problem reaching moisture out here in these plots that have been in no-till all these years. Matter of fact, we're getting stands practically every year in no-till, as well as the conventional till. And to be frank, I've done a lot of work on this over 3 decades. Fallow is very effective in trapping moisture in the seed zone because it breaks capillary continuity. Liquid water is moving up above that. It has to move as vapor. But where no-till is a real benefit is it's super great at for infiltrating any rain that you get. That'll move right down the profile. So if you get a rain sometime in the summer, and we seem to be getting a few more of those than we used to with climate change and everything, that will really set you up for a good no-till stand. And even if you don't get that, some of these farmers are still out successfully planting into no-till. So I do believe it. Farmers were saying that at the very beginning. Tim mentioned 1998 when this really sort of got going with the Direct Seed Association. The thought was the longer you no-till, the better it's going to be for retaining seed zone water in your no-till fallow. And I think that's the case. It's certainly here at Ron's on our experiments.
Well, and you've done work on like residue and water capture and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Do you do anything with that on your farm, Ron? Do you like run a stripper header or how do you manage it?
We never did a stripper header. We did the undercutter. We've done just about everything you can think of out here on some of this stuff. I think the biggest change, though, was the technology and the horsepower tractors because... I mean, they're still out there. The HC drill is still out there in the neighbor's fields, and the HC drill can only get through so much. And I don't remember what year we switched the plots, but I can remember distinctly we decided to split one of them to conventional seed and one to no-till seed. And we said we'd seed it. We split that one. We says we'd seed it regardless. And we've always had a stand there. We did that. We started it with winter trit or something.
That's a whole new treatment, not just a split of a plot.
But yeah, we started doing that and we got a crop and we didn't have to. I mean, it kept going. And it's always good. It's since that first time we did it, it's worked. It took a.
With deep furrow seeding and no-till fallow.
Yeah. It took a special drill that was put together down at the station to get it to do it, but it got done. And that was kind of the genesis of what we've got today for the most part.
Yes. And now the drills are way better than what we put together at the Lynn station.
Well, innovation has to start somewhere. Yeah. And it sounds, you know, never underestimate as much as I love soil, the equipment piece can be such an instrumental part in making the things work.
Well, and the biggest part of that equipment piece was Bob Papendick at that one meeting going, why are they still using the HC drill? It's because there was nothing else out there. And he goes, well, can we use some of this research money to do something about it? And we were told, yeah.
And that so was steep. Remember Steep?
That was PM10.
PM10, actually. So we actually had a deep furrow drill project. We said, the heck with these HZs. You can't seed through anything with them. These are the standard drills. These were the drills that came around in 1966 that allowed farmers to plant deep. Every farmer in this whole region went out and bought an HZ drill or an International 150, which is comparable. In 2010, a group of us got together and we gathered some money mm-hmm. and Papendick was involved. Mm-hmm. And then we got together with a group of farmers and we invited all the farmers in and boy, did they come. We had two meetings with well over 100 farmers and it was very interesting. We had the farmers involved saying, this is what you need to have and this and that. And so we at the station built two drills. John Jacobson was my technician at the time. Bruce Sauer was involved as well. And they just pretty much fabricated two of them. One was, I won't go into the details about these, but they, and then we had some private people. McGregor put together a drill. They invested a lot of funds. We had one Lynn farmer who actually put one together and we tested them over years and there were big improvements, but still not what we needed. I would credit really Derek Schaefer for working with AgPro to fine tune one of their hoe drills for dry land fallow seeding, and working with them to get something that really works. And Bruce Sauer, farm manager at Lind, now has one of those. Our deep furrow drill project really never went anywhere. We had a guy from Canada involved too. It was pretty wild. So,
but it got enough people interested,
yeah,
to start looking at what could be done.
Yeah, it did.
Well, we, you know, like Ron was talking about the Fields of Tomorrow thing, we brought a drill up from the station. It was a modified John Deere HZ drill. We went that route to start with because everybody had one, and that was probably the easiest thing that was going to, you know, work maybe. And, well, it kind of worked. I don't know. I don't know what your opinion was, Ron.
Well, the problem with the HZ drill and even some of the 9350s.
Like I said, we built several drills at the station and, you know, in cooperation with some other. Ron Kyle built one of the better ones that we're still using, built the frame and everything for us on that. And,
what makes a good drill?
What makes a good drill?
In your experience, or what is that, a little bit more about the experience?
One that has good seed placement, will go through the residue. That's one thing I have noticed with the no-till. They were talking about being able to seed into moisture, but what I've noticed is with Kim fallow, that, you know, as little as a quarter of an inch of rain and you can go out and seed it, where with the tilled fallow, you know, it takes a half inch or more, I don't know, maybe 3/4 inch to soak through that mulch layer so you can actually go out and seed it. So, with the Kim fallow, you can get in a lot earlier with a smaller rain and get it in and get it up.
Great. Thanks so much for that too, Bruce. It'd be maybe nice to, I'm going to ask a few of the actual questions I've prepared here. I'm hearing a little bit about some of the management questions that started the trials. I hear cheatgrass from that field day. I hear rhizoctonia being a concern. What are some of the other research questions you started trying to answer, and how have those evolved over the years of the trial?
Well, water infiltration's always been one that was involved.
We've extensively measured water out here all these decades, in the fall, after harvest, in the spring. So we have a pretty good handle on where the water is in the 6 feet all year long, and how crops affect that, and how winters affect that, stubble height and stubble quantity affect that. So.
You know, you're talking about this, I have at least like 10 more questions, right?
Yeah, right.
So what is your instrumentation? Did you pull cores and bake them off and measure the...
Neutron probes.
Neutron probes. And then at the surface, we use gravimetric, which is the hand samples, because the probes are not effective near at the top foot. So it's a lot of work, but a lot of data.
What's your favorite way in all of that sampling to conserve water or manage water?
Leave your stubble standing over winter. If you can cut it a little taller, that's great. Don't go out early in the spring. If you're going to till your fallow, you don't need to be out there in March or April. Our data show you don't even need to be out there in May most years. You can wait till June if you're going to do that, but that's not so practical if you're farming 10,000 acres of fallow ground, because it takes a while to get over it. But and we've seen that when I first came out here, these farmers, they would be out there in March tilling their fallow, you know, to seal it up. You don't see that anymore. And even you just drive around in April, here it is 1st of May, and there's many of them that have not. And so just don't need to do that. So there's been a lot of changes that farmers have made, mostly on their own observations, but certainly backed up by the research that we've done.
Right. Well, I know that part of your reputation, since you are kind of a legend, is doing really trying to back up some of those questions with the research. And what growers are seeing with you know, good trial design and statistics and, okay, is this something that happens, you know, once or in one place into something that is more likely to happen recurringly across a broader space.
And that's the benefit of long-term experiments, because the farmers can see those crops, and believe me, they watch during the bad years and the good years. It's out there for to see. And, you know, of course, that we share data openly, so nothing to hide.
So since you're talking about a little bit about trial design, how are you setting up your trials differently than, you know, if Ron, I think you have a lot of other experiments in your research portfolio on your farm, other than the long-term trial, but how is this set up differently? So you can run statistics and kind of have that repeatable, replicable, scientific kind of credential to these on-farm trials.
Well, all the trials I've led in the field have pretty much, not all, but most of them been just this randomized complete block design, which is a pretty standard design where you have some variability, but not too much. Anything we do in the lab or a greenhouse, we'd use a completely randomized design. I mean, this probably isn't much interest, but there's designs that are appropriate for the experiment that we learn in college, right? So
when you're doing an on-farm trial, and what does that look like when you're translating it from, you know, the research station to a working farm? And is there any difference? And, you know, making it so is Ron, who's doing the farming too? Is Bruce doing the farming? Are you doing the farming? Is Ron doing the farming on these plots? Like, what does that look like?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you farming around the 20-acre plot?
No, I mean, when we first started, we were using my equipment.
Yeah.
And that they were set up to fit my equipment. As things changed and equipment changed, I still did some of it. And Bill had one of his techs bring something and do part of it. Yeah. And it's a collaboration the whole way. I mean, it still is to this day. I harvested the plots for, I don't know how long.
A couple of years. The main thing, that we learned, and this is a lesson learned in cropping systems. I wrote a paper on that. Lessons for successful cropping systems. Hasn't been that well cited, but still a good paper.
So, I do think I read it.
Oh, did you? Okay, thank you. But the farmers are busy, and you can't expect the farmer to say, oh, hey, Ron, it's time to go plant spring canola, and I'd like that done this week. Well, Ron's sort of busy doing his own things. So after a couple of years using Ron's equipment, we realized that was just unfair of Ron. This is a huge trial. And so we converted it. So we did essentially all of the work in the plot so we could do it in a timely nature without being a pain in the butt to Ron. Because in fairness, you can't expect them to drop everything to go deal with our plots. And so that is an important lesson. If you expect to have your work done on time, plan on doing it yourself and don't try to mooch off the farmer.
Yeah, I think the other thing was the plot size, you know. So what are the lengths of that?
They started off 30 feet wide, 500 feet
500
long.
500 feet, I think that's
we were
important.
Using Ron's equipment. When we went to our smaller research equipment, we said, hey, we can narrow these. They're 60 feet wide. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they were
60 feet by 500. We said, hey, we can get twice as many treatments in here with just 30 feet wide and 500 feet long. So that right now, and for the, you know, for the last 25 year plus, it's been 56 plots out there, each 30 feet wide, 500 feet long. They're big.
Yeah.
That's just on the 20-acre one.
That's just on the 20-acre one.
All right. You guys keep alluding to like other trials you're doing. So you've got your crop rotation trial. What are some of the other things you guys have worked on?
We have a winter pea trial. It's not as big. It's only 100 feet long and it's not as wide. And then we have another one on the west side of Dewall Road here where we're looking at, I should say Surrender now, the canola triticale wheat, all with chem follow compared to traditional wheat follow. Also, no spring crops, and where we still have spring crops in this in this one.
Yeah, you've also got peas over there too, right?
And peas are an exciting new crop, as you can see that Ron's planting them, and your neighbor across the road,
Chester's got some.
Yeah.
Derek's got some. There's a bunch of peas out there now.
Yeah, and canola as well is if you can get it up.
Great. And do you? So these are, you've tried a lot of things in this trial, and I guess I want to circle back to the trial design and making that work on the working farm. I think there are some collaborations that maybe still try to do a scientifically valid design that's not fully the complete randomized block design or something like that to make that collaboration around the actual farming implementation a little easier.
From my point of view, being the producer and the farmer that has to deal with it, I mean, you got to let them have their hand, because if it's going to work, we want to know why. If it's not going to work, we want to know why. If someone comes from the government says, we want you to do it this way, we want to be able to say, no, we can't do it this way. We got to know, we have to document all this stuff. We have to prove what we're doing or why we're doing it factually. And so you kind of got to let them have their hand in the research and go, okay, if we got to do this, we got to do this. And just live with it. I mean, it's not that big a deal.
We always insisted on everything we do has to be publishable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Especially with the research collaboration side. Again, I know a lot of growers try stuff on their farm, and that, you know, this is part of the question is, what does the experimental design look like depending on the purpose?
Yeah. And it's like, the other thing was too, is like, what's it cost you to go to WSU and attend classes, or what does it cost me to have them come out here and give the class? It's, you know, it's easier for them to come here as far as I'm concerned. Right?
You know, one thing I want to say, Carol, Ron has been such a superb collaborating farmer. It's unbelievable. We've never even had an argument in all of these years. Nope. Maybe some minor disagreements, but it's incredible.
You know, I'd like the you know, the conventional tillage to disappear altogether. But you know, I get it.
Now you're on record saying
That's fine. No, I asked that this year too. Again, can we get rid of that out of the plots yet? No, we got to keep it there. Okay,
it's our control. We need to compare to what we've done in the past. That was the argument we made. We kind of need the control.
Yeah, the wheat follow is. Well, yeah, but sir, whatever you surrender and you decide is fine. The amount of data that we've published from this, I counted them up actually last night because I thought that might be a question. We have 22 publications so far directly from the Dre experiment. So
is he a co-author on these things?
He is on all of the ones, not on the scientific ones, but on all of the extension bulletins and all of the field day abstracts and anything that goes out to farmers.
Great. Do you have a favorite paper that you'd like to highlight?
Well, Tim, you've been
involved. Well, yeah, I think the favorite one was documenting that suppression of rhizoctone. It was an agronomy paper. We tended to kind of divide up. So Bill would do kind of the agronomy paper and then set the stage. And then we would come back later to try to explain it with some of our papers. But I really liked that one where we actually had the maps. We had the Bell graph, you know, looking over the 10 years, to, you know, increase in disease and then decline. I think that's probably one of my favorite papers.
It's not the one with the PLFA?
No, that was later on.
That was actually the one that's been most cited of Jeremy's papers is up at Al Johnson's farm, long-term study that we did for his PhD. But another popular one from Ron's here was the results of the first 8 years of annual spring cropping. Mm-hmm. That's received quite a few citations. It's been very interesting, and I'm sure it will continue under Dr. Singh's tutelage. And
so, Tim, you were talking about the rhizoctonia, and I made the crack about the PLFA. I would actually like to hear a little bit more about some of what Jeremy dug into during his graduate
work. Yeah, talk about Jeremy, because really the genesis of the work we've done the last 10 years was from Jeremy's work, asking that question of using canola as a rotation crop. What is the effect on the following crop? And so that led to the work with Ron and Reardon, and then another segment of that research was done out here at Ritzville. So you want to?
Do you have any like awesomely cited papers from this work, Jeremy? And what did you find?
Well, the paper that's been alluded to is a paper that was produced up at Hal Johnson's farm. Bill Schillinger and his crew had established experiments looking at winter wheat, winter canola rotation, followed by spring wheat. And they had documented over a 7-year period a reduction in spring wheat yield following canola. It just so happened that I'd been collecting soil samples from that experiment and storing them in the negative 80 freezer. So we went back and looked at through PLFA, which is phospholipid fatty acid analysis. Essentially, in that analysis, we're just looking at the microbial community. It's a way to quantitatively calculate the soil microbial biomass and then break that out into particular biomarkers such as bacteria, fungi, or specific fungi like AMF, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. It doesn't have the same resolution as DNA sequencing, but it's a great way to quantify soil microbial biomass. And after Tim and Bill had documented that these effects were not, the reduction in yield was not an artifact of soil moisture or disease or weed pressure, then we decided to look at the microbial community. And we did see a suppression of the microbial community following canola. And so, as Tim says, it wasn't a smoking gun, but it put us on the road, or at least a direction to follow as far as looking at yield reductions following canola. That led us to try to reproduce those same results here at Ron Dre's. And moisture has been alluded to in these conversations. I do think that there's a microbial component in yield reduction in this area, but any yield reduction we saw here at this location was mostly attributed to soil moisture.
Well, that's the only paper we have so far on this. Moisture was a factor, but there's also microbial data that has yet to be published, but will soon.
So basically what happened is when I became a member of Jeremy's committee at that time, a postdoc named Dan Slatter had joined my group and brought in a lot of these DNA tools. Unfortunately, we didn't have any DNA from that trial. So that's why we decided to set this one up. And so then we documented over that period of time the effect of canola in the rotation on the spring wheat. And the real take-home thing that seems to have come from that was AMF seems to play a big role in it. And Ron found that too with his PLFA data. And that's what we're really pursuing right now, is because canola is one of the few crops that are non-mycorrhizal, you tend to get a suppression of mycorrhizae the following year. And so we've also looked at the effect of triticale, barley, and probably the most interesting rotation of all of them from a microbiome point of view is that continuous spring wheat. That one has a completely different microbiome than anything else. So it's probably selected for something over that period of time. So right now we're going to go out there probably sampling in a few weeks. And right now we're concentrating on documenting what it's doing to the AMF fungi in the following crops and the crops themselves.
Great. I know that has been really important work in this area, especially as more people are incorporating canola into their rotations from both an agronomic and economic standpoint. Are you, or have you found any kind of takeaway best practices to help mitigate the impact of that?
Yeah, well, I think it's not a long-term impact. And I think some of your work showed that. So even though that 1 year you may get a reduction or suppression of AMF, the following year it will bounce back, especially if you have a broadleaf crop like peas or something. And in fact, that's kind of the impetus for a lot of this Piola research that people are doing, where you're intercropping the canola with the pea, with the idea of maybe maintaining the mycorrhizal status. The other thing that's still a big unknown is really what the role is of mycorrhizae in this cropping system. So a lot of the research has been done on horticulture crops, high rainfall crops, et cetera. We know the mycorrhizae are out here. We know we also have pretty high phosphorus conditions here. So the question is, What benefits are the mycorrhizae providing it? If you've already got high phosphorus condition, that's one of the mechanisms that's been well documented to help plants take up increasing levels of phosphorus. And I have a hunch that it might have something to do with water relations and drought. So it's really wide open. It's only been within the last 10 years that the technology has out there that we can really identify what is out there. Before, we could only, you can't culture them in the lab. You can't, you know, you've got to grow them on living plants in the greenhouse. All the identifications were made based on spores. So if you didn't have the spores, you had no idea of who was in the root. So now we have those tools and with sequencing. So that's something we're going to pursue.
And regarding AMF, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, we have done a trial out here at Ron's where we inoculated, because that was a question that we got a lot from growers is, if we're suppressing AMF, can we inoculate and improve yields? We did a trial with one of Dave Huggins' graduate students, Cassandra Reeser, where we inoculated and we saw a trend for higher yields, but not statistically significant. And I think Tim alluded to this. It's the native populations, the AMF, that are doing the work out there. It's really hard in this environment to introduce AMF and have them survive. Those inoculations might be more suited for a greenhouse study or small plot vegetable crops. But out here, it's really hard to get AMF off the shelf to establish.
I hear it's kind of hard living out here, so maybe that has something to do with it.
Well, it's
that's kind of been one of our questions all along, is what can the researchers do? Because, I mean, over the last 28 years, the technology has changed. The things that we can test for and look at weren't available when we started. And so it was like, what can we do? And what can we, what is actually physically able to look at?
And yeah, I mean, that's what, one of my questions around just the microbiome. And when we add things into the microbiome, if they're selected for an ideal condition, and then we put them somewhere, you know, as lovely as Ritzville, but also might not be best suited for all of the living organisms.
You're almost leading into where we're headed next with what we've talked about at our last meeting and what we want to do out here, which is what is a healthy soil for Adams County or for Lynn or Ritzville? Not just, you know, oh, well, this is what a healthy soil looks like. Well, is that really what it is? Because moisture is a limiting factor out here. So what rhizomes and what microflora and fauna are going to actually exist?
Awesome. As we get some of these lessons learned out of Dr. Schillinger and kind of capstone this retrospective a little bit, and then we'll have the mic pass to where we're going next with this. So with that, Bill and Ron and Tim, do you guys have like, what are your, we've been, there's been so much work done in this space, but what are some of the key takeaways that you've really learned throughout the course of this work together and how that's different from each of your perspectives?
Peas are easy.
Winter triticale is easy too, except it won't pay for itself. It will outproduce wheat consistently by 15% year after year, drought year, wet year, Ritzville, Horse Heaven Hills, Lind, you name it. It'll always do that. There's work being done by Josh Hegarty down at the University of California, Davis, and some other people to incorporate triticale into bread, having some better bread quality characteristics in triticale, but with still maintaining its yield and to raise that price bar for triticale. Triticale right now is a feed grain. Feed grains are sell for less than a food grain like wheat, except for this year, which was very interesting.
Not depressing, though.
This last year, you could have received more money for triticale than you could for the similar volume of wheat. But that's really an outlier. If you go back to 20 years, that didn't happen. So, but triticale is easy to grow. It's disease resistant. It never freezes out. It's one tough customer.
Well, and it can add a lot of carbon to the soil too, from what I understand.
Not really. That's one of our findings. It does not produce any more biomass, straw biomass, than winter wheat. It looks like it does because it grows so tall and those stems are so thick. but it doesn't produce nearly as many stems. And so we measured that and reported that. We do a lot of weird measurements as researchers, and that was one of them. And it's it does not produce more residue than wheat at either Lind or Ritzville. So
yeah, and another interesting thing, it may not be a problem out here, but triticale is much more tolerant of acid soil conditions.
Something I'm actually, as you guys are talking about food quality type triticale, you know, I've heard that rye can make really nice sourdough. And I know that nobody wants rye probably in the crop rotation out here, but I do wonder like how trit might do in that context.
Feral rye can be a huge problem. And farmers are already nervous because triticale is a wheat rye cross. It's got what they call rye blood. And when it volunteers, you can certainly notice because it's growing 8 inches taller than your wheat. But it's not feral rye. And so that's a long term. I like winter triticale. I think if it's easy to grow, it uses less water than wheat in the long run. You'd never measure that in 1 year, but you will over 10 years plus. Will it ever catch on? Not unless it's competitive economically with wheat. But maybe if these breeders get some better bread quality into the triticale, and that could happen. Some bakers really like it. They say it imparts a very unique flavor. You know, not a lot. Maybe only 10% of the flour is trit, but still.
Well, there again, the trit—it's a market thing, just the same as the peas. The peas is a market thing. I mean, we did try spring peas before we came along with the winter pea. The spring pea out here was, we're not gonna. Never mind. But the winter peas, there again, we started out with yellows. They're working on coming up with greens because they have a better, larger market and a better price, unless you go to the grocery store and you see what they charge you for yellow peas. The canola is the same thing. We were sending canola to Montana and Canada. We were sending the yellow mustard to Montana. Well, now we've got markets, more local markets that are willing to help us out and deal with these things. And it makes it more economical that way.
The marketing piece really, you know, you need diverse markets to have diverse rotations.
Right.
And that it's just really the fundamental part of that, isn't it? Well, okay, you guys have grown some weird stuff, it sounds like. What was the weirdest thing you've grown? Was it the safflower or something else?
Safflower is easy to grow. The big slam on safflower is it dries your soil down to nothing, just like a Russian thistle.
Also, it hurts. The chaff on it is like the worst thing I've ever seen.
It's a thistle.
It is. And you don't like that in your socks. At least I don't.
But we had flax. I had flax out here in a plot in a 20-acre piece.
Ooh, how'd the flax do?
They were pretty.
Yeah.
But it was not the... There again, marketing. I had to haul them all the way down to Clarkston to be cleaned. And then... I sold them up in Okanagan.
Oh, that sounds inefficient.
Very inefficient.
Yeah.
We had a crop called fenugreek out here. That was actually pretty interesting. Smelled like a maple syrup factory out there for a while.
Yeah, that's a crop widely grown in North Africa.
Yeah.
Probably I don't hear that you don't want your cows to eat that one.
No. And that's, there's a few other things that come that they derive from fenugreek that you want to women that are close to having children, you don't want them out there either.
Yeah.
And then your dry land alfalfa.
The dry land alfalfa wasn't a complete disaster.
But it was an interesting.
Yeah. But that predated Roundup Ready alfalfa. And I think that a person could do something with dry land alfalfa with the Roundup Ready stuff to help control the weeds and that. A little bit of everything.
Bill, do you have a favorite weird crop?
Well, it's not weird. Camelina. We looked at that long and hard and continue to do so.
Did you bring your duct tape for all the combine equipment?
Yeah, that's the joke, and that's the truth about very small seeded
special sieves to even harvest it.
But yeah, and it's not economically viable so far, and it too had a negative effect on the following wheat crop. And Jeremy did a paper on that one as well.
Do you want to talk about that?
Who was down there at the time that gave us all the millet seed?
Oh, yeah. Melops, we tried to.
Yeah.
You did try. So, okay, let's have Jeremy talk about Camelina for a second. Then I want to hear about millet. People, I saw a Capital Press article about millet. We got to talk about millet.
So we asked the same question of yield suppression following Camelina. And there were Camelina plots at Lind that we pulled samples from and saw suppression of spring wheat following Camelina as well. And some of the suppression, there's a question of whether it's because it's a non-host for AMF or if it's because of the glucosinolates that are associated with the plant that are actually suppressing the microbiome. And Camelina has a little bit higher glucosinolate content. So if that is the cause, it would have more potential to create a suppression in the microbiome. But we did see that is one of the plots where we saw a rebound, where we came out of the rotation with Camelina within a year. The microbiome had bounced back to what it had been previously. And so it was like when we went back into winter wheat, that was their home. That's what they're used to. And I think we referred to that as a legacy effect. So once we get back to winter wheat, then they're happy again. Yeah, Camelina we covered in a very similar way.
Thanks for that, Jeremy. And now I got to hear about, you threw some millet seed in the ground out here too. How'd that look?
The millet seed didn't like it at all. It never got warm enough. It stayed purple. It's very short. I don't remember how many varieties that they brought out. And most of them didn't even put heads on them. So we learned really fast that warm season crops don't like it out here.
Yeah. When was that? I mean, you know, maybe climate change will...
late 90s. We have not yet identified a spring crop that we can consistently grow out here in the drylands without this extreme variability in yield. And so I say yet. So that's why we have surrender.
I'm excited to see some of the soil health components highlighted. I think that's going to be a real asset as foundational to maybe some of the buffer capacity, not just around acidity, but around kind of the moisture.
Well, and I think too that because of the work that we did with the spring cropping, I mean, it's pushed the research and it's pushed the interest into the chem fallow and making and seeing that actually we can make this work. We don't have all the answers yet to the timeline or, you know, how long that transition period is like we do with the spring stuff, but it's doable.
Yeah. So, Bill, I'm really excited to hear more from Surendra, but I really want to hear if you have any of your kind of final thoughts around long-term trials on farm, working with growers, multidisciplinary collaboration. You've done so much. Do you have any kind of last words of wisdom before we hear where what the fate of the project is, where it's going next?
Well, I don't know about words of wisdom, but, when I was hired by WSU in late 1992, I was told that, you know, Lind is one tough place and you have 5 years essentially to prove yourself or you're not going to get tenured and you won't be here anymore. So make sure you do something that's successful.
No pressure.
Well, I didn't even really think about that at all. I just went out and tried to have fun and I reached out to growers. And over the course of, 29 years, I probably did 60% of my work in growers' fields, a lot of it here at Ron's, about half of it here at Ron's and the others all over the place, literally, you know, Douglas County, Horse Heavens, you know, Palouse. It's just been really fun. And growers always had good ideas. All of these trials have always been developed in consultation with farmers. The farmers had to want the trial. Some of it involves some long-term equipment or commitments. You know, Ron here has been, you know, over.
Like Bill says, though, but it wasn't just me, the farmer. It was my neighbors as well that sat in on these things and says, this is what we want to do. It wasn't just my idea by any means or in any way. And it continues not to do that. I mean, we involve as many growers and neighbors that are interested.
Yeah, good point, Ron. And when I started work, I did a lot of work down the Horsehaven Hills just because it's so dry. It's driest wheat country in the world.
Yeah, we've talked to some of the folks down there and heard a little bit about that, too.
And so I was interested in working down there, and I got Papendick involved, Bob Papendick. And I said, will you come down to a meeting? I have a meeting lined up with the Horsehaven Hill farmers. So we went down there in early December, and the farmers had a lunch, and we met at their Grange Hall out in the middle of nowhere up there. And I laid it out, and I said, this first trial that I'm proposing is going to be 6 years, and it's going to involve a lot of work from the cooperating farmers. And we spent all day up there talking about this and what we're going to do. We tried some yellow mustard, which was a complete failure. We did a lot of things. And that was just the first of several trials up in the Horsehaven Hills. And during all of that time, relationships have just really been great. I looked forward to going to work practically every day, unless that was meeting or something.
Yeah, I didn't have so many Zoom meetings probably at that time.
But, I had a great time. I feel very fortunate and to be able to come do this work. And I think Surendra is a great hire. And I hope you are out here and have just as much fun as I did, Surendra.
Yeah, and I'd also like to make a few comments about this collaboration that I've had with Bill over the years and the fact that we've been able to leverage so much. Because without that, I would not have seen the problems, the disease problems out there, and I wouldn't have really been able to do that kind of applied research. So at the USDA, we very much have a mission goal to try to figure out how to help the growers with management, et cetera. So I think that collaboration, he provided all the agronomy, which I never would have done. So essentially, I'm kind of like a parasite. I hate to say that, Bill, but basically, piggybacking on the work and the trials and everything. So I don't have to do that. And of course, we don't really have much of a field problem with our unit anymore as we've had cutbacks. But I could essentially come onto that site, take the samples, ask the scientific questions, work with Bill to publish. So that kind of collaboration, I think, is another key part of this whole project.
And it is. And I'm remiss for not bringing that up. Collaboration with scientists from WSU, ARS, Oregon State, and elsewhere has been key. And if you're doing cropping systems research, I'm an agronomist, I don't have all these other skills. And so collaboration has been very key. And I couldn't see how you can be successful unless you had some really productive collaborators.
And that was it. I mean, if I had a question, we'd ask the question. The next question would be, wait, who can answer this question? Mm-hmm. And we had a whole slew of people to pick from it in that sense.
Yeah. How many researchers have you had on your farm over the years, Ron?
I can't even keep track
many
anymore.
Dozens.
And what do you feel like is kind of key to that, keeping those relationships really positive and making sure that, everybody feels good around that kind of network and that kind of work?
As a producer, you have to understand that they have certain things that they have, criteria that they have to meet. They got to be able to publish it, for one. They have to have the equipment that they need to look at the question that we have. I mean, that was always something that, it's just kind of a back and forth thing and just a sharing of assets.
It's worked really smooth here, always.
Well, I have to say, so Tim, I think we all know that parasites are things that don't give a net benefit.
Okay, I should correct myself. I call it a symbiotic relationship.
That's mutualism.
Mutualistic symbiotic relationship. Yes. Although some people argue symbiosis parasite. I'm not going to get into that. but yeah, it's basically been a symbiotic, but I could not have done the work myself.
Framework of the cropping systems question and being able to piggyback all of these transdisciplinary and applied questions and having the grower perspective. And you're a pro at these days we're calling it stakeholder engagement in the co-production of research. And so you've been doing that for decades.
Well, if you're out here, you better be doing something useful for them or else they're not going to have much interest.
Well, I know you guys, this study is a legend. And Bill, you have done such amazing work for the ag community in this region. And I just want to say thank you. It's been really wonderful to, you know, even though we haven't necessarily worked alongside each other, I've definitely read some of your papers, followed your work. I'm always inspired by that legacy. So thank you for the work you've done.
Well, thank you, Carol. But it truly is and has been a group effort with many collaborators and support staff. Bruce Sauer, several technicians I've had through the decades.
They say teamwork makes the dream work. So it sounds like that's been a really big part of the legacy as well. But with that, I'm really excited to just invite you to pass your mic to Dr. Singh so that we can spend a little bit of time in this interview before we wrap up. So Dr. Singh, I'm hearing that you've had your first meetings of the, you know, soliciting the input of all of the stakeholders and introducing yourself and not just you as part of the Lynn Station at this point. So, and it sounds like hopefully it's been a grand welcome.
Yes, it has been. And the biggest part that I consider myself lucky to already done the heavy lifting by Ron, Bill, Tim, that now we have a huge background of information to build upon and having these long-term trials. It's been a really commendable job done. So I really want to continue working and answer more and more questions. And now that we go forward into the more conservation of soil and into soil health systems, it's and also the new challenges like herbicide resistance, weeds, and all these new issues are popping up. The previous researcher and the growers collaboration here really set up the stage for us to dig deeper into those future challenges, and will continue to. So yeah, that's really grateful. And my mentor used to say the long-term trials are exactly like a living laboratories that you can continue answer a whole plethora of questions, whether it is from soil health science, microbiome, rhizosphere, weed science, pathology, you just name it. Now the carbon emissions and everything. We continue to have meetings with farmers in the region, and Ron has been to a couple of them to decide what is going to be the future direction and how can we answer better using these trials, that what exactly the soil health from our region looks like and what it should support and how we can continue to improve upon it, and looking at the importance of having tilled fallow at the control, that how much we have already improved and where we can go from there. Is there a plateau of improvement in soil health or soil carbon per se? So yeah, those all research areas we are really excited about, and it obviously it wouldn't be possible without the grower support and the previous work done by scientists and Bill specifically here.
Great. I'm really looking forward to hearing more and watching more as that evolves. So are you still asking questions about cheatgrass, or, you know, what are the research questions more specifically for the long-term cropping systems trials that you're inheriting?
So yeah, there are a lot of questions, and these long-term trials also give us opportunity to invite the expertise I myself may not have. We are taking Tim's and Jeremy's help on to answering the more microbial questions. And now we have new soil health scientist, Dr. Shikha Singh, Haley Neely. And we have all the scientists on board to answer the question about pretty much everything we are facing, and diving deep into soil health science of it and how it compares to the native healthy soils. So, yeah.
Great. And there's some biosolids work that you're doing too still?
Yes, that's an interesting study. And that is also just like Tim mentioned, we are just piggybacking on Bill's research. This is a trial established by Dr. Schillinger and at the Lind station. So last year when we were in the field, we saw really, really lush wheat growth compared to the neighboring wheat. And then we dig deeper, what was there? And that turns out to be the old biosolid trial, which was concluded a couple of years ago. I think the papers were published in 2022. And So then we thought like there's something definitely going on. So we just went ahead and sampled the soil and sent for analysis, and we found out, yes, there is a lot of residual effects. I like to call it legacy of biosolids compared. And that those trials has like a tillage, undercut and distillage and biosolids and synthetic fertilizer, these four treatments in different combinations. And so we looked at the yield, and then the harvest season came. We look at the yield components and grain protein and everything from the trial. And it turns out that even after 7 years of application, there is still a considerable amount of nutrient present, improved carbon, and yields are still showing up improvements, and grain protein is still not higher in those biosolids. So it's comparable to synthetic fertilizers. So yeah, that's how I got into the biosolid science. And now that we have the confirmed results, we want to continue tracking down not only on the benefits of it, but also on the other side, like how much heavy metals PFAS contains and everything is available, so that we can actually answer is in a whole, not only looking at the agronomy side of it, but also from environmental and food side of the questions from that trial.
Yeah, this is the fun thing about cropping systems, isn't it? There's so many different pieces to it. Ron, have you been watching those biosolids trials on the farm?
Actually, I've been using biosolids longer than they've been using them at the research station.
So is your input helping to shape some of the questions that Surendra's asking over there?
To some extent, yes. No, but we started biosolids back in 1986, I believe, and worked with WSU and the guys over at Puyallup that they were doing it at that time, and come up with a lot of stuff out here and a lot of numbers just right out here in front of the house.
Yeah.
So
awesome. Well, so as we wrap up, I'm interested to know, you know, as you've been part of this legacy of long-term trials on your farm, how has that affected your management over the years? And are there things that you do differently that you might not have because of the collaboration, aside from farming around a 20-acre piece there, well, that you've given to the researchers?
I don't know that I'd ever gone and done spring cropping on everything the way I did if we hadn't have been doing some of this. I know that I'm absolutely positive that there wouldn't be a 40-foot drill setting out here that can go through no-till fallow in the fall if we hadn't have been doing some of this. There's a lot of things that have taken place that have been incorporated on the farm here, and there's been a lot of things that have been stopped or done away with because of the research that we were doing out there. I mean, you know, like I said, if you've got WSU coming here and doing the research, you're the first one to get the answers to the questions, right?
And it's super relevant to your farm.
Absolutely. I mean, it's everybody wants to have the variety plots on their farm so they can, you know exactly what variety to plant next year. It's kind of the same thing.
No, that's great. Thank you so much. Tim, do you have any final thoughts?
You were asking that question, what did we learn? And I would have two or three lessons from a disease point of view. The first thing is that a shift in a management practice like tillage will have an effect on diseases. And so that was an important lesson. The second lesson I think that we learned was that you can have natural disease suppression taking place. It may take a few years for that to happen, but, you know, things kind of reach an equilibrium. And then the third thing from all this canola work that we've done, looking at all the different microbiomes, is that in reality, the plants share a lot of the same microbiomes. I mean, we can try to find some that are unique, but in the end, they're just gobbling up everything that the plant's putting out there. And so there's a lot of commonality, but there still is that legacy effect. And I think that that's something that we've seen in some of the rotation crops that can have on the following wheat crop. So, and then one more thing, you know, this camelina, thing. You know, we've had this DOE grant we've been working on for about 4 years, and I know that Camelina kind of had its heyday and then it's kind of declined. But I'm wondering whether there's still a place maybe for winter Camelina, if they could breed good winter Camelina. The spring Camelina, you know, obviously isn't going to work in this system. So I wonder whether that's another up-and-coming possibility of a rotation crop that could be work out here.
Nice. I hear there's some work going on at the station in that vein. So I look forward to, maybe we'll see it at the field day. awesome. Okay. Surrender, what's the weirdest thing you're going to grow in this trial? Because you've got such a great background around dryland cropping systems. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what that looks like.
Well, weirdest, I think, for researchers, nothing is weird until unless we have the data. So I would like to put it a different way, that I would like to try everything possible we can do to continue improving our system. So, yeah, I wouldn't call anything weird, to be honest. Yeah, it's just that hit and try. And it's like it's more important to learn what not to do than what to do. So in this, like, you know, a little more unforgiving environment, it's more important to learn it that way. And yes, and we have such an advantage of, like, try things on small scale and tell that, yeah, this works or this doesn't work, and pass on the results.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like Bill mentioned earlier, you know, that first year we put it out there, and we looked really, really smart that first year. One more year and we looked really like, what are you guys doing?
You know, that's part of the research process too.
One hit wonders, you know?
Try to make it look good. No, that's great. I am interested a little bit about, you know, the role of the research plots and then how to scale those up. And how do you know when it's time to try that or when to scale it up? And that kind of the role of the research from an applied perspective. Can you speak to that?
Well, what we've done in the past is try to set the research plots up that they get a full cycle. So if it's a 4-year rotation, a 2-year, or 3-year rotation, so give it that time. So every rep has its opportunity. And at that point, then sit down and look and go, okay, did we have some success? Where did we not have success? What's going on? And reevaluate at that time. You know, it's like I mentioned, you know, the 1 year's information doesn't give us enough. 2 years doesn't necessarily give us enough. And so these long-term plots, that's what's made them successful, but it takes patience. It takes patience on everybody's part, including those that have to fund it and those of us that got to live with it, because it's not going to happen fast. I mean, it's, you know, we are a production system, but our production line takes a full year to get through it. Unfortunately, it's not like we're making cars or toothbrushes, and it's like, oh, that when we got to make a change in the line here, it sometimes takes a couple of years to make that change.
Well, with that, thank you so much for having us all out on your farm today. Really appreciate Dr. Schillinger that you have come out of retirement for a moment to speak with us, to hear a bit more about this great work you've done. Dr. Politz, thank you so much for all that you have to offer. Always a net benefit. Dr. Singh, very much looking forward to the trajectory of the Lind research and all of your program that's based from the station, and I'm sure will affect the greater region. Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom as PLFA master and master of the microbiome. And Bruce, thanks for all that you do, because making the research run, it wouldn't be possible without it. So thanks again, Ron. Thanks to all of you. And thanks to our listeners for joining us. As always, a big thank you to our guests today for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience with us. This podcast is produced by the PNW Farmers Network team with music credit to Carlos Flores. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers alone and do not represent that of the PNW Farmers Network or any associated agencies.
Please remember that experimental results will vary, and listeners are encouraged to try things at home. If you like what you heard, please support this work by sharing, rating, and reviewing. And do consider joining us as a guest or nominating a friend who is trying things on their farm. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, happy trials.